Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides. And alongside me is nobody this week. It is just me. Unfortunately, Josh's schedule did not allow him to be available for this. So no big deal. I don't want to say no big deal. I don't miss having him on. It's a lot easier and more fun for me to be talking with somebody else. But like I said, it's just the way that it goes. Sometimes we're both married with kids. And so sometimes scheduling just does not work out, but I do want to welcome you, the listener, to the show. Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. We are getting towards the end of Strikeforce. We still have a full year worth of episodes in terms of 2012, a full year. That is not a full year of us doing this show. We actually only have a few months left before we are done with our run here. But on today's episode, we will be discussing Strikeforce Melendez versus Masvidal, which took place on December 17, 2011 at the Valley View Casino Center in San Diego, California. In the main event, El Nino Gilbert Melendez would put the Strikeforce lightweight belt on the line against rising challenger game-bred Jorge Masvidal. In the co-main event, Chris Cyborg would return to the Strikeforce cage after an extended layoff to defend her Strikeforce women's featherweight title against Japanese challenger Hiroko Yamanaka. Also in the card, Gegard Mousasi would battle Ovince St. Preux, and KJ Nunes would tangle with Billy Evangelista. I do want to mention that Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com. All right, as we like to do, we want to talk about fallout from the previous Strikeforce event, which was Strikeforce Barnett versus Haritanov. This was a very momentous event for Strikeforce, as we saw a new Strikeforce middleweight champion crowned, with Luke Rockhold winning a hotly contested unanimous decision over Jacare Souza to capture the belt. We also saw the finals of the heavyweight Grand Prix set, with Daniel Cormier and Josh Barnett both winning their fights to advance to what looked like a very intriguing finals matchup. There would be some news, by the way, regarding the Strikeforce heavyweight division announced shortly. So let's get to that actually in just a second. But in terms of this card that we're talking about, there was a lot of news around Strikeforce in the lead up to this event. And I want to touch on a bunch of stuff here. But Ken Hirschman, it's a name that not many in MMA may remember today, but he was a Showtime executive who really championed MMA while he was their head of sports division. He helped bring both Elite XC and then Strikeforce on board during his stint with the premium cable channel. And when Hirschman left in October of 2011, Strikeforce's deal with Showtime was just about up. Many wondered if this might be it for the promotion, because without a TV deal, how viable was Strikeforce? And especially at a time when the promotion was struggling to find its footing, both with ratings and in terms of attendance at arenas. So this was a big question mark. However, it turned out to be much ado about nothing, as Strikeforce and Showtime would agree to a new deal, keeping the promotion on the channel. There were no terms announced with the deal, but we would see, you know, obviously we know looking back 10 years later now, Strikeforce would continue with Showtime through the end of its run, with the last card taking place in January of 2013. So we saw just over a year from the signing of the deal to when it would, you know, basically conclude when Strikeforce got folded. But it was interesting, as part of the Showtime announcement, there were other very intriguing tidbits of information that were revealed. And so I'm going to run down through these. UFC president Dana White, who had appeared to distance himself from Strikeforce when Zuffa bought Strikeforce, Dana had said that it would be Scott's show to run. Scott and Showtime could do what they wanted to do. But now it had been decided that he was going to become way more involved with the promotion, despite having a very strained relationship with Showtime. And both he and Scott Coker seemed to be speaking for the promotion, which was, to say the least, very interesting. Strikeforce would be cutting back on the number of its events as part of this deal. This was a promotion that never had a massive roster. A lot of the fighters that competed on the undercard, the prelims, were not regularly contracted, you know, with multi-fight contracts, that sort of thing. We know that the heavyweight division for a long time was really barren, not a lot of challengers there. We also, you know, while the lightweight and welterweight and middleweight divisions were, you know, there was a lot there, there wasn't always a lot of depth to the light heavyweight division. The women's bantamweight division had been growing, but the featherweight division was not. It was pretty much, as Dana put it, really all about Cyborg. That was really all there was there. Not a lot of great Or at least I say great challengers, but not a lot of really intriguing challengers there. So I guess you could make a case for cutting back, but yeah, they were going to be going back to producing only 6 to 8 events per year. So no longer were they going to be doing monthly events. Also the challengers events, which had kind of filled the gap in between these main tentpole events, that was going away. We're going to cover the final two challengers events during this episode, but this would be it. So, you know, became a question of, are they going to have enough fighters? What's going to happen? And Dana said, well, we'd actually be seeing more fighters being signed by Strikeforce, which was rather interesting. So, yeah. So, and then in addition, once the heavyweight Grand Prix was completed, once we saw a winner of that, which would be determined again between Josh Barnett and Daniel Cormier, the heavyweight division would be eliminated, which would leave Strikeforce with their women's bantamweight and featherweight divisions, as well as the men's lightweight, welterweight, middleweight, and light heavyweight divisions. We were also promised we'd get new champions crowned in the welterweight and light heavyweight divisions. As you might remember, the 170-pound title had been vacated when Nick Diaz headed over to the UFC, while the light heavies needed a new champion after Dan Henderson had also headed back to compete inside the octagon. And then finally, one of the Strikeforce divisions that did not need a champion crown was the lightweight division, as Gilbert Melendez, who Dana White had recently announced would be heading over to the UFC, had actually re-signed with Strikeforce, and he would be defending his title on the card, obviously, that we're covering on this show. So a lot going on. It really gave some clarification to the direction of the promotion. Again, there was whispers and worries that it might shut down at this point if they couldn't strike a deal with Showtime, and instead they'd be moving forward. And this was all supposed to be seen as positive for Strikeforce in retrospect. Not so much when you're cutting back on the number of events, when you're losing, you know, a division that you have, while it's traditionally not been one of your strongest divisions, but you have invested over a year in the, you know, the heavyweight Grand Prix, and you're going to say, okay, well, that's it. Now we're done. It could have been something that I remember Scott Coker saying at that time that he would put up his heavyweight division against any other heavyweight division for any other promotion, and he could definitely make a case for that. And Josh and I have talked about that on previous episodes. We do feel like the UFC overall had a better heavyweight division, but it definitely was close, and we saw a bunch of Strikeforce heavyweights head over to the UFC. But yeah, in retrospect, I mean, you know, we had seen the death knell for the promotion when they got bought by the UFC. They were on their way out from the beginning of that. But, you know, this at the time was spun as something positive. But I think in retrospect, I just, you know, hindsight's 2020, but it just couldn't have been negative. You're cutting back on divisions. You're cutting back on events. I mean, come on. So, but with Gilbert Melendez slated to defend his title, all we needed was a challenger, and it would end up being the surging Jorge Masvidal. And other bouts on the card that we're talking about today, KJ Nunes would battle Billy Evangelista. Former light heavyweight champ Gegard Mousasi would take on Ovince St. Preux. And in the championship co-main event, Chris Cyborg would return from a lengthy layoff to defend her title against Japanese star Hiroko Yamanaka. All right, I mentioned the Challengers events being closed out. There were two that took place between Barnett versus Khairatonov and Melendez versus Masvidal. Strikeforce Challengers Larkin versus Rossborough took place on September 23rd, 2011 at the Palms Casino Resort in Las Vegas. There were a few notable competitors on the card, including current UFC fighter Bobby Green, who submitted Sharon Spain, Ryan Couture, who took a majority decision over Maka Watson, and then Lorenz Larkin. He took a unanimous decision victory over Nick Rossborough in the main event. And then on the next and final Challengers card, Britt versus Sayers, it took place on November 18, 2011 at the Palms Casino Resort in Las Vegas. There would also be several recognizable fighters on this one. Bobby Green was back, got another submission victory. Derek Brunson, current UFC fighter, took home a decision victory. Fellow current UFC fighter Anthony Smith got knocked out by Adlan Agamov. And then in her second Strikeforce fight, Ronda Rousey submitted Julia Budd with an armbar 39 seconds into their bout. And then in the main event and the very last Strikeforce Challengers fight, we saw Lumumba Sayers knock out Antoine Britt in just 28 seconds. So that's a piece of Strikeforce history. All gone. No more Challengers cards. All right, but this brings us to the event that we are talking about today. Strikeforce Melendez versus Masvidal again took place on December 17, 2011 at the Valley View Casino Center in San Diego, California. Strikeforce had been at this venue before, and now they were back. On the call would be Mara Rinaldo, Frank Shamrock, and Pat Miletich. The attendance had to be disappointing. A paltry 2,995 fans, so just five fans under 3,000 in attendance. Again, this is a promotion that at its first event had drawn 18,000, had drawn 10,000 or more multiple times. We'd seen the attendance start to slide, but this one, man, under 3,000. I mean, we'd seen challengers events with, you know, over 2,000 fans. So, you know, for them to be drawing short of 3,000, and especially for a card with two championship bouts on it, including the lightweight championship, which was probably their marquee belt. And then, you know, Chris Cyborg, who you're pretty much guaranteed to see domination and destruction, for them not to draw 3,000 fans, I mean, that just had to be seen as pretty negative. On the positive side, they did garner an average of 460,000 viewers on Showtime, which was up from what we'd been seeing recently. But man, this just, I really think after the Zuffa deal that, you know, fans just saw the writing on the wall, and it was kind of like, this is a second class organization. Even if, you know, even if, as we have firmly established on this podcast, even if Strikeforce was never truly a competitor to the UFC, you know, at least it was the underdog. It was, you know, David taking on Goliath. There was something that drew fans in. The fights were fun. It was an alternative, etc. Now that they'd been bought, it's honestly, it kind of shows that, you know, we like to talk wrestling on this podcast, but you know, when WWF bought WCW, you know, it was, oh, they're going to run WCW as a separate, as its own promotion, etc. It just doesn't work. It just does not work. Fans know who really owns it, who's really running it, and there's a reason why they run things differently. You're not going to let another promotion run differently than yours, and it's just, we saw that kind of proved out here. I think fans realized it. I know that as a huge fan of Strikeforce, again, I attended the last Strikeforce kickboxing event, gone to the first Strikeforce MMA event, you know, had worked for the promotion. I knew that the wind had definitely been taken out of my sails when the promotion got bought, and I was not nearly as much of a fan. I don't even know if I watched any 2012 Strikeforce events. I've been noticing the ones we've done recently, I hadn't even watched. I wasn't working for the promotion at this time. So, you know, it was, the bloom was off the rose for me as well. And I think a lot of fans felt the same way. But we should talk about the undercard. Let's get to the event itself. Eddie Mendez defeated Fernando Gonzalez at 185 pounds via decision. And then at 170 pounds, Herman Torrado defeated Chris Brown via submission, coming away of armbar at 405 of the third round. At a heavyweight bout, Devin Cole defeated Gabriel Salinas Jones via unanimous decision. And then in the co-main event of the undercard, Karis Fodor, who was a hot prospect for Strikeforce at this time, at 155 pounds, he defeated Justin Wilcox via KO, come away of punches at 13 seconds of the first round. So a very, very quick knockout for Fodor, who of course always makes me think of Fedor. And then in a catchweight bout at 181 pounds, Roger Bowling defeated Jaron Peoples via KO, come by way of punches at 42 seconds of the first round. And I know Peoples, he really took a shot there. Those are, I believe both those fights are on UFC Fight Pass, and they're worth checking out. And will take you less than a minute of your time to check out both fights. So definitely worth checking out. But this brings us to the main card in the opening bout. We saw KJ Nunes take on Billy Evangelista at 155 pounds. Coming into the fight, former Elite XC lightweight champion, KJ Nunes was 10-4 coming in, and he was on a two-fight losing streak, unfortunately, going down in a defeat at the hands of Nick Diaz and Jorge Masvidal, respectively. This was the first losing streak of his MMA career, so he had changed things up. He had gotten with a new coach, was trying to really kind of, you know, like I said, switch things up. Prior to those losses, Nunes was on a six-fight win streak, so he was looking to turn things around here. And then Evangelista was also coming off a loss. He had suffered his first professional defeat to Jorge Masvidal in his most recent fight, and he now had an 11-1 record. He had been seen as a rising star, a guy that was undefeated in Strikeforce, and maybe he was somebody to look at for a possible title shot. And then the Masvidal loss had kind of taken some of the shine off. However, a win over a former world champion like KJ Nunes would go a long way towards restoring his rise to stardom. All right, bringing us to the action itself. Good reaction from the hometown San Diego crowd for KJ Nunes. Apparently, this was brought up on commentary before the fight. Nunes had said that if he couldn't beat Evangelista, that maybe he shouldn't be fighting. So he kind of hinted at walking away from competing professionally, apparently. And Frank Shamrock had talked on commentary about how he didn't like that. That's really not a good mindset to have coming into a fight. But this would be a good one for him. He surprisingly went for a really good takedown early and got it in the first round, though Evangelista was able to scramble back up quickly. And after some more trading on the feet, Evangelista got a nice lift and slam takedown, though Nunes was able to get back up quickly himself. Both fighters landed some decent strikes, with Evangelista having a slight edge. I probably would have given him the first round 10-9, though you could have made a case for possibly even a tie. In the second round, things got pretty entertaining. Both fighters landed some really nice strikes. Evangelista seemed to want to turn this into a firefight, and he was smiling and shaking his head at Nunes, almost saying that he wasn't being hurt by Nunes' punches. Still, Nunes was clearly landing regularly and scoring, so I gave the second round to him 10-9. Both fighters landed nice punches early in the third, with Nunes also catching Evangelista with a nice high kick. Evangelista smiled again and shook his head, but it was definitely a scoring shot for Nunes. And then Evangelista, and really the big highlight for him besides some of the punches that he landed, he grabbed a standing darce choke, and things looked pretty bad for Nunes. He looked like he was caught. It was definitely on tight. However, Nunes was able to use good positioning. He essentially kind of dropped down to his belly, and that was able to that helped him to be able to get his head out, and it drew a big reaction from the crowd. Toward the end of the round, the two combatants began talking to each other, seemingly telling each other, hey, let's go. Just a really entertaining fight overall. I gave Nunes it was a close fight, but I definitely gave him the final round. And so the fight 29-28 in favor of KJ Nunes, which the judges agreed with. Fun fight, which saw KJ Nunes defeat Billy Evangelista via unanimous decision. Nunes would be back to take on Josh Thompson in a very intriguing fight in the first quarter of 2012. This would be it for Evangelista in Strikeforce. He would be scheduled to take on James Terry inside the Hexagon in 2012, but the fight would be canceled for unknown reasons, and instead Evangelista would go 2-2 over his final four fights, retiring with a 13-3 record in 2014. All right, in our next bout at 205 pounds, Gegard Mousasi would take on Ovince St. Pro. Former Strikeforce light heavyweight champion Gegard Mousasi was 32-3-2 coming in. He had fought to a majority draw 8 months earlier in an entertaining bloodbath with the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine. Since then, he'd gotten a first-round KO in a bout in Japan and was undefeated since losing his belt to King Mo in his first Strikeforce title defense. OSP was 11-4 coming in. He had 8 straight wins, which tells you that he had kind of a middling start to his career. He'd been started off his career 3-4, but then had won 8 straight, including 4 in Strikeforce. He'd beaten Antoine Britt, Benji Raddick, Obongo Humphrey, and Joe Kaysen inside the Hexagon. But this would be a massive step up in competition for the former Tennessee Volunteer football player. All right, once the bell rang, Mousasi, he was just all over OSP in the opening frame. After some trading and feeling out on the feet, Mousasi was able to get the fight to the mat and drop some good punches from the top. OSP was able to scramble and almost get back up, and Mousasi was able to bring it back down to the mat. After getting a very tight Kimura in, which saw OSP made a nice move on this. He had, if you remember the Frank Mir, Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira submission where he snapped his arm with the Kimura, Gegard Mousasi had that level of positioning, and OSP kind of jumped and rolled forward to take all the tension off his arm. It was a really sweet and slick move on his part. Mousasi, as a result, got reversed briefly, but he was able to get back on top, and he got OSP in a crucifix and dropped some really nice shots from the top. Very entertaining round, 10-9 for the former champ in Mousasi. He also dominated the first few minutes of the second round, getting top position again and dropping solid strikes. The ref stood things up a little surprisingly, and Pat Miletich, who was clearly not a big fan of refs stepping in like that, made a point of it on commentary. But OSP used that to get Mousasi to the mat while taking top position. He wasn't able to do much damage, and Mousasi was able to scramble and get back to his feet. And after sprawling on an OSP shot, the horn sounded, another 10-9 Mousasi round. You could really see there's Mousasi, whose Achilles heel had always been his wrestling, and we'd seen that when he lost his title to King Mo, where he just repeatedly got taken down. I mean, he didn't sustain a lot of damage, but he just kept getting taken down. In this fight, you could see that it was something that he had worked on because he was just much improved in terms of his grappling. He got another nice set of takedowns in the final round of this fight. While OSP got a couple of his own, the difference was that Musasi was usually able to inflict damage when he had position, while OSP would be unable to. And when he did late in the fight, it was just simply a case of too little, too late. I'd probably give the final round to OSP, but it just wasn't enough. 29-28 Musasi, and again, the judges agreed with me, and they saw it that way as well. Gegard Musasi defeated Ovince St. Pro via unanimous decision on this one. As far as after the fight, OSP would be back in Strikeforce in 2012, while Musasi would be scheduled to fight in Strikeforce the following year too against Mike Kyle, but the bout would be canceled due to a Kyle injury. For some reason, he was not rescheduled during the year, so instead, Musasi, the former champ, would be back to compete on the very last Strikeforce card in January of 2013. All right, we are moving along very quickly here. I'll just stop and mention quickly, when it's me and Josh on here, we like to, you know, kind of go down some rabbit holes. We like to talk about, again, wrestling or just kind of whatever catches our fancy while we're talking. There's very little of it that's, I mean, we go off of a script, of course, of some sort, but there's a lot of ad-libbing and you know, we don't just simply read off a script. You know, it's more of a, when him and I are going back and forth, it's more of a free-flowing conversation. So we tend to go down rabbit holes and eat up a lot of time sometimes. And I mean, you're listening to this for leisure. As far as I know, this isn't being taught in a college class or something like that where, hey, this is the curriculum. If it is, please let me know, because that would be very interesting to know. But when it's just me and I'm not going off on these tangents, but you know, with somebody else, we tend to go a lot quicker. Whether that's good or bad, that's up to you. It's subjective and totally your call. But yeah, we are burning through these pretty quick. But there is, despite the length of this third fight, the co-main event, there is a lot to cover here, and then we'll go over the main event as well. But in the co-main event, Chris Cyborg would take on Hiroko Yamanaka in defense of her Strikeforce Women's Featherweight Championship. Cyborg, she was 10-1 at this point in her career with four straight wins in Strikeforce. She had been completely dominant since winning the belt. So dominant, in fact, that in interviews leading up to the fight, she stated she wanted to start taking fights at both 135 and 145 pounds, as there just were not many true competitors for her in the featherweight division. In fact, she'd been out of action inside the MMA cage for a year and a half due to a lack of competition, and then just a contract impasse as well. So you know what, ring rust might be a factor in this fight. That was kind of the thought coming in. Hiroko Yamanaka, for her part, she was 12-1, so actually a little bit more experienced in MMA than Cyborg. She was on an 8-fight win streak, and she had some solid wins on her record, including having won over previous Cyborg title challenger Hitomi Akano. So despite being a pretty big underdog, she was seen as a threat to Cyborg. She was also taller. This was the first time in Cyborg's career that she would face a fighter that was taller than her, and she had a 3-inch reach advantage. And Cyborg, on top of all that herself, she stated that Yamanaka would present a solid challenge to the belt. So, you know, it could be an intriguing fight. I do want to mention, once we got to, you know, watching the actual events, I learned before the fight that Yamanaka had gotten into MMA because she wanted to get in better shape. A lot of us do. But also because she thought it would help her get better at her job as a dominatrix at an S&M club in Japan. Mara Rinaldo was nice enough to dig up that piece of information and share it on commentary, and then toss it to Frank Shamrock, who was, as you might imagine, at a loss for words and really unsure of how to respond to that. So that was a kind of an LOL moment during the event itself. But nice reaction for Cyborg. It was funny. So when she's coming down to the cage, I'm kind of like keeping an ear out to, you know, what song are they coming down to the cage, you know, listening to. And a lot of times it's a rap song or a rock song or some sort of pop, you know, contemporary pop song or whatever. So I'm listening and I'm like, I feel like I recognize this song, but it's not a mainstream hit. I'm like, man, where do I? And so I put my ear close to the speaker, and I realized she was coming to the cage to the song Free to Run, which is a contemporary Christian song that was popular back in 2011. I do remember that song. I recognized it. And then when Cyborg, in her very hoarse, rather deep voice, started singing along with it, I was like, okay, I definitely know this song. So kind of interesting. She was praising God as she came down to the cage. And, you know, we've talked before about the whole idea of like someone beating somebody up and then saying, thank you, Jesus, for giving me the power to do this afterwards is kind of weird. But anyways, but yeah. All right, but this would be for the fight itself, would be a very quick one. All the talk of Yamanaka being a threat turned out to be absolutely empty. Yamanaka got caught by a Cyborg right hand. Basically, Cyborg threw a left and then two rights, and the right hand just caught Yamanaka in the face flush. He was immediately dropped. The champ swarmed. Yamanaka, to her credit, initially survived, but when she got up again, she got dropped again. The ref stepped in and stopped the fight just 16 seconds in. On that, watching it live, I thought it was an early stoppage. The ref's back was kind of covering a little bit of the camera shot, and and Yamanaka was clearly rising to her feet, and Miletic pointed that out on commentary. But I mean, didn't really matter. It was clearly Cyborg's fight, and I should mention that once they showed the entire fight on replay, the ref stoppage looked a lot better, a lot more credible. Essentially, the ref stepped in when Yamanaka was still down, and then Cyborg stopped punching her because the ref had stepped in, and that's when she started rising, and it was bang, bang. Like, it happened really quickly, so it was kind of hard to see, but I actually think it was a good stoppage because with her still down, she'd been dropped. Cyborg's just pouring it on. She's not going to stop punching. I think the ref just simply saved her from further damage, and it was very clear these two were light years apart on their feet. I mean, you could see it immediately, and this was it. I mean, Cyborg was just on another level with her striking. Yes, there are women today, such as Amanda Nunes, that can stand with her, maybe Holly Holm or somebody like that, but there are just so few female fighters that can in any way compete with Cyborg on the feet, and you could see that just in spades during this card. So this was it. Once the fight was done, Miletic mentioned Cyborg Rousey, saying that he'd love to see that fight. Might have been the first one in MMA to call for it, which we unfortunately would never get to see. Rousey was fighting at 145 pounds at this point, but would end up dropping down to 135. And then for those that aren't aware, basically the two would have a war of words, with Rousey saying, hey, you need to come down to my weight class, and Cyborg trying to, and she was too big, and trying to make the fight at 140, and Rousey didn't want to do that, and there's a lot of information out there on that. I would have loved to have seen that fight because it was a situation where, yes, Cyborg is a brilliant Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. She wasn't definitely no slouch on the ground, but Ronda was obviously an Olympic medalist in judo and could snap your arm. And I just think that, I mean, obviously it's not that I think that, it would have been an absolutely intriguing fight. And so on the microphone, Cyborg was asked about it, and she asked her about Rhonda, and said, yeah, and her at that time broken English essentially said, yeah, this girl talks too much, and the crowd kind of oohed, and they had just shown Rousey on camera. I would have loved to have seen Rousey either go into the cage or show her face on, if they'd shown her face on camera while, so we could have gotten a reaction shot, but they showed Rhonda on camera, and she smiled that beautiful smile and waved and all that stuff, which was cool to see. But yeah, Cyborg, she made it clear that's really who she had in mind next. But again, unfortunately, we never get to see that fight. So the official tally was Chris Cyborg defeated Hiroko Yamanaka via KO comeaway of punches at 16 seconds of the first round. Or did she? Stay with me just a second here. Yamanaka would be back in Strikeforce the following year. However, this would not be the case for the champ. This would be the last that we would see of Chris Cyborg in Strikeforce. And it wasn't because of injury, it wasn't because of lack of competition or anything, a contract dispute, none of that stuff. Instead, we would not see Chris Cyborg again because her reputation and credibility had been soiled by the fact that she had tested positive for stenozolol, an anabolic steroid. That's right. This fight, she had come in on steroids, and as a result of the positive test, the result of the fight would be overturned and changed to a no contest. Cyborg would be stripped of her belt and suspended for a year. This would also again end up ultimately end up stopping her run with Strikeforce, as the promotion would fold before her contract, before her suspension was up, and so she wasn't able to come back. And Cyborg would state on her website that she had failed the test because she had taken a dietary supplement that she had been assured would was legal. She was having trouble cutting weight, and so she had taken this dietary supplement. She'd been told that it was fine. And you know, she did accept responsibility for the test and, you know, hey, anything you put in your body is your responsibility. She apologized to Yamanaka, the promotion, all the fans, etc. But it didn't matter. Again, it would spell the end of her title reign, her run at the promotions, and also the chances of her going to the UFC at that time. Just a very costly error in judgment. Dana White had made it clear that he was not a big fan of Cyborg's. And this really probably paved the way for Ronda Rousey to become kind of the it girl in MMA and open the door for her to go over to the UFC. So, you know, despite all that, though, however, I am a big fan of Cyborg. She's currently the Bellator Women's Featherweight Champion. She holds a record of 25-2-1, and she's gone on to have one of the most successful careers in MMA history. And she may even be the woman's GOAT. But even if she's not, she's absolutely on the Mount Rushmore of female MMA fighters. I mean, you can put Ronda on there, you can put Nunez on there, and you can put Cyborg on there, and then that fourth spot may be up a little bit for. There's other women that you can debate, you know, whether it's Miesha Tate or Marlos Kunin or, you know, some Holly Holm, somebody like that. I mean, there are definitely some great fighters that you could look at for that fourth spot. But you really, I don't know that you could make a case for Cyborg, Nunez and Rousey, you know, not being the top three female fighters of all time. And then even going further than that, regardless of gender, Cyborg is the only fighter in MMA history to hold titles in four major MMA promotions: Strikeforce, Invicta, the UFC, and Bellator. I mean, that's pretty amazing. That's not something Ronda Rousey ever did. She never was with Bellator or Invicta. That's not something that Miesha Tate has done. That's not something that Amanda Nunez has done. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So to me, she's the best. She's the most celebrated women's fighter of all time. And even though she's been fighting for as long as she has, she is still, you know, one of the best female fighters out there. So pretty amazing. It's just sad that somebody that was, you know, such a big figure in Strikeforce would end her career with that promotion, or her at least her run with that promotion, with such a, you know, just such a negative, on such a negative tone. It's unfortunate. You know, there's always been whispers about her. I mean, based on her appearance, based on her voice, that, you know, she must, like her musculature, that, you know, there's always been rumors that she's done steroids and just hasn't been caught, you know, that sort of thing. I can't speak to any of that. That, you know, again, that's really up to, you know, people if they want to speculate on that kind of thing. But regardless, this was the only time that she's ever popped for, you know, for anything during her career. So, you know, you can take that as you will, but yeah, despite that, I mean, would that have made a difference in this fight? I kind of doubt it, but you know, hey, I guess we'll never know. But this brings us to the main event, which was Gilbert Melendez, El Nino, defending his Strikeforce Lightweight Championship against Gamebred Jorge Masvidal. This was his third defense of the title. He was 19-2 coming in. Talking about Melendez, he'd won five straight overall. After seemingly being headed to the UFC, Dana White had announced that Melendez instead had reversed course and re-signed with his hometown promotion, and now he'd be facing a big challenge in Jorge Masvidal, who was 22-6 coming in. He'd won three of his last four fights, including two in Strikeforce, with wins over Billy Evangelista and KJ Nunes. This was a pre-Street Jesus Masvidal. His hair was buzzed, and or not necessarily buzzed, but very, very close cropped. But he was definitely a star on the rise, very experienced, already had 28 fights. I mean, at his age, that was a big deal. But yeah, this was a guy that, you know, hey, if somebody could stand and bang with a guy like Melendez, it was definitely Jorge Masvidal. And that's what we would see in this fight. In the first round, it appears that Masvidal wanted to turn it into a slugfest while Melendez was fighting more of a tactical fight on the feet. The champ's accuracy was the difference, and while Gamebred made it clear the strikes weren't hurting him, he was eating them, and the champ was scoring. In an interesting sequence in the first round, Melendez grabbed a standing guillotine, which he used to throw knees to the head, and Masvidal kept trying to put his hand down so that the knees would be illegal. So El Nino, responding to that, grabbed his hand and threw more knees, which was kind of funny to see that, and very smart, very, very cerebral move for Melendez. 10-9 after the first round. Masvidal once again proved his toughness in the second round, but Melendez was clearly the crisper, more technical striker, and he was piling up points with his punches, 10-9 for the champ after two. Melendez's aggression was on full display in the middle frame, as he seemingly every single time that Masvidal would throw a strike, he would eat two in return. Despite that, it was El Nino who was showing damage on his face with a solid amount of swelling around his eyes. The third round was definitely close. I could have gone either way, but I probably gave it to Masvidal, which gave him his first round, still 2-1 in my estimation for Melendez. More stand-up in the fourth and the fifth round, both of them, Melendez again standing out despite his face looking the worse for wear. Masvidal really needed to go for it, but he just seemed to be unable to really pull the trigger and land that big punch that would put Melendez on his back foot. Melendez just never stopped moving forward. He's like the Terminator. And the fourth round, another round for the champ, and the final was more the same. Again, Masvidal scoring, but not really able to break through. And Melendez showing off that superior technical striking ability. Another round for the champ, who clearly won in my mind. You could have made a case for it being a clean sweep, but it really, while neither fighter never had the other fighter in danger, it was definitely a competitive fight. It was pretty clear that Melendez was a cut above Masvidal at this point. I felt like these guys could have gone another few rounds. I mean, their gas tanks were super impressive and super necessary. However, the fight itself, it was not super entertaining in my mind. Yes, it had, you know, it was high octane, and they were always on the go, and there were very few lulls. Neither fighter had any huge highlights. You know, neither of them got dropped really. And, you know, despite both scoring with a ton of strikes, neither one of them just really stood out as just, oh, you know, he was putting him on his back or anything like that. So Gilbert Melendez defeated Jorge Masvidal via unanimous decision to retain the Strikeforce lightweight champion, lightweight championship. Both these fighters will be back in Strikeforce the next year, with Melendez back to complete a trilogy with Josh Thompson. And I'm looking forward to covering that one for sure. But that was Melendez versus Masvidal. We do have some more information to wrap things up with. We already mentioned that Cyborg had tested positive for a steroid. Several other fighters, including Melendez, Masvidal, Musasi, and OSP, were tested for both drugs of abuse, such as cocaine, as well as performance enhancers, and all tested clean except for Cyborg. Total disclosed fighter payroll, this is interesting, $154,075. And Melendez, he got $150,000, the first fight of his new contract. No win bonus. He earned almost the entire gate himself. Jorge Masvidal got $23,000. Cyborg got $66,000 with $33,000 win bonus. By the way, her suspension was for a year and a $2,500 a fine. Obviously, that's a much different situation today. The fines are a lot more, and you know, they have much stiffer penalties than they used to. Hiroki Yamanaka, for getting just destroyed, she earned $8,000. Gegard Mousasi also got $150,000. Ovince St. Pro got $17,000. KJ Nunes got $65,000, including a $30,000 win bonus, and then Billy Evangelista got $20,000. So again, I said total disclosed fighter payroll was $154,000. I'm sorry, that was the gate. The gate was $154,000, because obviously just Melendez and Mousasi, they pulled in $300,000 between the two of them. And doing a quick estimate, if you look at the rest, they pulled in another $100,000, probably another $200,000. So this was probably, and this isn't including the fighters on the undercard, so you're talking $450,000 to $500,000, you know, in fighter payroll, basically, and you only brought in $154,000 from the gate. Obviously, that's not including, you know, whatever Showtime paid them, and then, you know, I'm sure they split the concessions with the arena, or I don't know, maybe the arena gets all the concessions. I don't know how that all works. It's hard to think that this wasn't a money loser in terms, you know, of Strikeforce. So, but it was, despite all that, another entertaining Strikeforce card. Three of the fights went the distance, but they were still pretty entertaining. Nunes versus Evangelista and Mousasi versus OSP were both fun to watch, while we got to see more Cyborg destruction. And then in the main event, Gilbert Melendez really further cemented himself as one of the best lightweights in the world, while Jorge Masvidal showed that he could hang with the very best. But that pretty much wraps things up. I'm happy to announce I got a couple cool announcements here, but Ryan Couture, the son of one of the all-time greats in Randy Couture. Ryan fought several times with Strikeforce towards the end of the promotion, and Ryan is also he runs the Extreme Couture gym in Las Vegas, Nevada today. He ended up going on to the UFC, and you know, he carved out a respectable career for himself. You know, he didn't attain the legacy of his father Randy, but Ryan, a very good pro and obviously a great coach. I believe Extreme Couture was just named MMA Gym of the Year by MMA Junkie. They are the home base for Francis Ngannou, the UFC heavyweight champion. And so Ryan has agreed to come on the show as a guest. I'm really excited to interview him. We had some contact back in the day, and so we're going to reconnect, and he's excited to come and talk about Strikeforce, or the good old days, as he called it. And then I'm also super excited to mention that former Strikeforce welterweight champion Nate Marquardt has agreed to come on the show. And so I'm really excited about talk about that. Marquardt had perhaps the most brutal knockout in all of Strikeforce history, the uppercut knockout of Tyron Woodley, which garnered him the Strikeforce welterweight championship. I'm excited to cover that one. And Marquardt is going to come on the show. We're going to talk about that and talk about his run with the promotion before we wrap things up. Coming up next, however, we're going to be covering Rockhold versus Jardine. It featured the first middleweight title defense for Luke Rockhold. We'd also see appearances from King Mo, Robbie Lawler, and Tyron Woodley. So this should be a fun one to cover. Almost a fun run. Sorry, The Office fans. Fun one to cover. So we got some cool stuff coming up as we look to wrap things up. This is hitting the feed on January 10th. The way that things are right now, we are scheduled to wrap up the show at the end of March. Of course, that's dependent on, you know, if we take any more breaks, that sort of thing. And I should mention, I apologize, we weren't planning to take a break last week, but scheduling and different things, just the new year and that sort of thing just kept us from being able to record. We don't have any more scheduled breaks through the end of our run. I'm really hoping that we can just continue to power through as, again, we come towards the end of Strikeforce. While we have a full calendar year, 2012, of Strikeforce events to cover, again, they'd been cut back and there's only seven more Strikeforce cards in 2012. And then there's one in January of 2013, and that wraps things up. So we only have eight more Strikeforce events to cover. Like I said, we've got two fighter interviews. I'm hoping to secure a couple more. I've got a couple more in mind. I've reached out to a couple fighters. King Mo has agreed to come on, but we haven't been able to get that scheduled yet, so I'd like to have that. I've reached out to Luke Rockhold to see if we can have him on. I was in contact with Tyron Woodley's team over the summer before the first Jake Paul fight, so I reached back out to see if we can have, he wasn't able to come on at that time, and hoping he'll be able to now make some time to be able to come on. So I did get to know Tyron a little bit, so I'd love to make that happen. And then I'll let you know that the one other thing that I really want to do is we have the trilogy between Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez. Gilbert has come on the show already. He came on early on in our podcast run. Josh has agreed to come on the show, but we've just never been, I've been basically saving him because I really want to have, I'd love to be able to have both of them come on at the same time. And if not, maybe I'll talk to them both separately. We can call it together into one or two episodes, but I would love to have them both on at the same time to be able to talk about their trilogy of fights. I think it would be fun to do that. And so I'm looking to do that. So we'll see what happens there. But with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. Again, you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. I really, really appreciate any type of feedback that I can get from you. I'd love to hear from you. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. We hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.